Good morning. Live from Studio 5, this is First Coast Connect on 89.9. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Jessica Palumbo in for Melissa Ross. First Coast Connect is always live on the radio, and now you can subscribe to our daily podcast on iTunes or Stitcher. Just ahead, Cultural Council of Greater Jacksonville is here with the latest cultural happenings in Jacksonville. Also coming up, Ability Housing of Northeast Florida is about 80% toward its crowdfunding goal to help ease the transition for homeless or disabled Jacksonville residents getting roofs over their heads. Then later, Vietnam War heroes will be honored in Jacksonville this weekend. That and more is ahead today. But first this morning, the Cultural Council of Greater Jacksonville is an arm of city government that awards money to cultural organizations. But with publicly funded art come critics asking why tax money should be spent on what some don't consider a necessary government function. Here in studio this morning to talk about what the Cultural Council is and what it does, we have Executive Director Tony Allegretti. Good morning, Tony.
Hey, good morning, Jessica. Thanks for having me.
And also here is the Council's Christy Holacek, who heads up the Art in Public Places program. Hi, Christy.
Good morning.
And also Communications Manager Daniel Austin is here. Good morning, Daniel.
Good morning, Jessica.
A studio full of culture this morning. And to our listeners, what do you want to know about the arts and culture here in Jacksonville? Do you have a question or a comment about public art? Join the conversation at 549-2937 now. So, Tony, first, let's talk about some myths and misconceptions. Maybe you hear from people that makes you think they don't understand what the council is or what it does.
So really, I would say you opened that there was critics about art funding. There's not so much critics as there is some education that we have to do. The investment that our city makes in arts and culture is a very small piece of the budget, 0.2%, and we show a tremendous return on investment. And so basically, what we have to do is tell folks what we get out of that. So of the 2.4 or so million that we invest in the re-granting that we do with cultural nonprofits, we see a $70.8 million return. And you'd be hard-pressed to find another piece of the budget that gets that kind of return, and these are solid numbers. So, from an economic standpoint, we get very little resistance once we make our case. And then when you look at the quality of life and the ripple effect of all the great stuff that these folks do, it's a slam dunk. So.
Yeah, so you're talking about $78 million return.
70.8. So yeah, it's okay.
70.8.
Don't get me in trouble, Jessica. Yeah.
Return on investment, and that investment is made in the form of grants, right?
Sure. So yeah, exactly. So basically, what we do is the Cultural Council gets a lump sum. We then re-grant it to 21 orgs. Those orgs have, they go through a rigorous process. It's a big application. They get site visits. They get, audits, both audits for, financials, but insurance, and make sure they're really strong and have excellence in their programming. And then we have hearings, and then really we dole it out pro rata based on their budget and based on, the work that they do. So it's a long, arduous process, and we're good stewards of that. We're really held up for the way that we grant make. We have a panel of 10 leaders in the community that are all vetted by city council and passed through city council. And then they do their hard work. And at the end of it, we dole it out, get very good feedback. And that's how we know the return on investments, because we get all those numbers back from those guys.
And the recipients of those include museums, theater companies,
orchestras. That's right. Yeah. The big ones, symphony, all the way down to little arts nonprofits that are in neighborhoods that are working strictly with kids and arts. Really across the board, we had 21 that we have the ROI for with that $70.8 million. We have 23 coming in for this next budget cycle.
Okay. And full disclosure, WJCT is one of the organizations that receives that city grant from the Cultural Council. So besides the grant administration, what other core functions does the council serve?
Thanks for asking. So we're a three-legged stool. So one leg of the stool is that cultural service grant. It's arguably, not even arguably, it's our cornerstone. It's the most important leg. And sorry, Christy's here. Art in Public Places is another huge leg, and it's also mandated by the ordinance. And then we the third leg is we privately fundraise and do grants directly to artists and to projects.
Okay. Recently, at the swearing-in ceremony for City Council President Greg Anderson, I understand he requested the Cultural Council to do some work. What did he ask?
Yeah, absolutely. So he invited artists. So we had artists in the lobby, and they interacted. Many of them were from his neighborhood, and so he had relationships with them. We made custom-made, hand-printed through Print Jacks, commemorative posters that we gave out. So he really is deeply involved with us. He's on one of Christie's art selection panels right now. We feel like President Anderson is going to be a tremendous asset for arts and culture for this coming year.
Okay. And research has shown the impact of the arts and culture industry here in Northeast Florida, and that is $2.4 billion?
Right. So we know that 70.8 is those 21 orgs, but it doesn't include Jazz Fest, live music, you know, One Spark, things that are innovative in our community, our creative community, kind of the Richard Florida effect. And so we did a deep dive, and we studied all those jobs. So, you know, the top job was photographer. I think second was singers and musicians, and third was authors and writers. But it's huge. It even counts, you know, creative and ad agencies, that sort of the creative economy. $2.4 billion in 2013 with about 27,000 jobs. So it took us from a place, like, folks in this room know that we're a creative culture and we have a creative city, but we wanted to take that from optimism to confidence, so that you know, we can walk around saying, "Hey, we're you know, we are this." Mm-hmm. So,
and why do we need a cultural council to get that benefit?
Yeah, so well, we're quasi-governmental, you know, so you want your city to support these things. We are a bit of a bureaucracy, and it's set up in a way that our city has a strong base and roots. If you go to any city in the world, you're going for the cultural attributes. And this is a way to make sure that we're on firm ground, that we are always growing, and that we are always looking for excellence in arts and culture.
So going to another leg of the stool, Christy Holacek, a lot of what people actually see, the tangible cultural council projects, are your department, right? The Art in Public Places. And that is set up through the city's Art in Public Places ordinance. So tell us about what that ordinance requires.
Sure. The ordinance was established in 1997. And it essentially is a percent for art ordinance. So every building construction project of a city facility sets aside 0.75% for public art integration at the site. This is actually one of about 300 programs nationwide, as well as over 30 in the state of Florida. So we're really working with the other cities and aligned to bring public art to public spaces. It's really a fantastic program. It was established, as you mentioned, in 97 with the Peyton and Delaney administration in support of that as well.
And you said that it sets aside a budget for construction for public art.
Yes. So it's a percent, again, 0.75% for public art to be installed at that city facility. So Better Jacksonville Plan projects are really the best example. Between 2000 and 2006, we had the construction of the main library and as well as other branch libraries throughout the county. And this is a countywide program. Mm-hmm. The arena, the ballpark, all of those were great examples of how the ordinance functions properly. Essentially, new construction, artists are brought in at the design stage, and they really work to integrate a public art component into that construction project.
And at the library, that component is what?
The artist was Larry Kirkland, and in the niche of the library is Wisdom, which is a bronze owl, and it really is symbolic of the building, which is, again, the characteristic of this work, is that it should be site-specific. It should represent what the resource or the function is. Again, it's a public facility. Mm-hmm. So we want to bring that attention and identity to the site.
Right, and that's the owl that's kind of looking out over Hemming Park there at the corner.
Yes.
Everybody knows. We're talking now with Tony Allegretti, Christy Holacek, and Daniel Austin with the Cultural Council of Greater Jacksonville. Join the conversation at 549-2937. And Christy, I understand we're about to undertake, we're in the beginning stages of one of the biggest public art asks that the city has made, and that's at the Duval Courthouse, right?
That's correct.
Where are we in that process?
Well, that is actually the final Better Jacksonville Plan project. And we are, you know, really in a good position now where the construction has been completed. And essentially, the space is open for an opportunity for the public art. Again, that was the percent of art that was set aside for the project. So we're bringing in stakeholders and community representatives right now to really look at the site and understand, again, what is the function of this facility? How can we best use this public space to be a community opportunity? Community is, again, engaged. There's a lot of opportunity for that involvement. So we're looking at the neighborhoods, and we're looking at how this really, the largest public art project in the city of Jacksonville, will be iconic and impactful for the city.
And that's a huge budget for that project, right?
It is. It's $866,000.
Wow.
Now, that also includes administration and maintenance. So we're also looking at the sustainability. So the project is not just art only. It essentially involves a variety of different components. And we'll make a call out to international artists, and they'll come to our city, the finalists will, and they'll work with the community. So it's a really beautiful process.
And that, again, the price tag on that is a reflection of the total cost of the building of the courthouse, right? Because that was such a huge...
It's actually on the initial construction and design cost of the facility. So when the program, or when the actual building construction project grew, our budget didn't.
And the neat thing that we're doing with this project is we're taking public comment on it as well. Yeah. So every time we have these public art projects, Chrissy puts together with her Art and Public Places Committee an art selection panel, which will be the volunteer committee that will, you know, be made of stakeholders and community members that will help decide ultimately what will shape the project and what it'll look like. And with this project, since it is such a big, impactful project, we wanted to get community response. So we're letting people tell us what they'd like to see on social media using the hashtag CourthousePublicArt. And then we've got a running blog on our website, so people can check that out at culturalcouncil.org. And we've got all kinds of comments that people are bringing in, and we will present that to the art selection panel. They'll take that information and use that to inform the process.
Right. Okay. We have some calls waiting on the line. Robert is calling from Riverside. Good morning, Robert. You're on the air.
Good morning. I just wanted to say that I really appreciate the Art in Public Places, especially the Sean Thurston murals, and I really love the garden bombing that's in Hemming Plaza. I think we should have more art in public places. I think it gives downtown Jacksonville a great feel, and that it's not just a bunch of, you know, boring buildings.
Thanks for your comment, Robert. All right, and next we have Tim. Tim is also calling from Riverside. Tim, good morning. You're on the air.
Hi, I think that's Tim. Tony, this is Tim with the Jack's Literary Festival. I wanted to ask about what's going on with the James Johnson Park, and if you could maybe talk about the possibility of a sculpture going in there.
Sure, and that question again was about James Weldon Johnson Park.
Yeah, it's actually Lift Every Voice and Sing Park because it celebrates both the brothers Johnson, James Weldon and John Rosamond Johnson. We dedicated the park at their birth site and home in La Villa. Right now, it's sort of just a grassy space. It does have great markers that were donated by the Durkeyville Historical Society. That we are working on a befitting art project, public art project there. We've got sort of fundamental approval of funding with DIA. We're working through how that's going to work. That's going to be an excellent project. Those, if you haven't studied the Brothers Johnson, please do so. They are they're true heroes to Jacksonville, Florida. And so what we'll do is when we get that process going, we have a stakeholder meeting coming up, I think even next week, to set the stage for that. But you'll hear more about that, and we'll probably reach out to the private sector to help, because this is such an important project for Jacksonville. City funding is going to be great, but I think this one, to do something befitting these two guys, we need to go big on this budget. And to be honest, that park and this art project should be a destination. I mean, people will actually come here because these guys inspired so many. So, and that song, I mean, the song is just so many people know every single word of that song, and we need to memorialize it for sure.
So it remains to be seen what form that art will take in the.
Oh yeah, so it'll go through the regular process. So there's no idea what it'll be, mm-hmm. But it's going to be significant.
All right, thank you, Tim, for the question. Going back to art in public places, the city council allocated a lot of money, a huge chunk of money, $400,000 or so for public art in the urban core. So, Christy, can you tell us about any progress that's been made on those types of projects?
Sure. Again, Art in Public Places is going to have a big year this year in 2016, really for the next few years. The projects that you're referencing are the Downtown Investment Authority's urban art projects. And what's interesting about, again, Art in Public Places is that we're actually installing permanent public art in city facilities. So there is sometimes a difference and a wider conversation right now that public art is everyone really has an opportunity to create public art. But these pieces specifically are going to be more functional and interactive, and they're engaging at the street level. And we're looking at specific areas of town, and we're wondering how can we enliven this space. And we are looking to complete probably about 20 projects in phase one. There'll be three phases. So the neighborhood and the community can begin to see this art coming into Lara Street and the kind of Hemming Plaza and main library. And then they'll see it ripple out into phase two and three, which goes into the Elbow and the other surrounding area.
All right. We have a comment on our Facebook page. JP says, the bed tax recently used to renovate the Jaguars video boards could also be used for other things that promote entertainment and tourism in the city. I believe the Cultural Council should get a piece of that money every year.
Boom. Tony. Way to go, JP. Yeah. Well, we really are trying to tie ourselves to tourism. This year, we're making a concerted effort. 16,000 people stay overnight in Duval every day. And so what are they doing? They're going to the museums, they're doing plays. I mean, we know there's infographics to prove it. So there's an amazing momentum, and we're one of the few places in Florida that has any room. You know, we've got vacancy, so we've got real room to grow. And I think tourism dollars are so precious, and we do stand ready to take advantage. But I think to JP's point is what we want to do is we want to increase the tourism. So I'm not going to go and fight for any kind of piece of that money until I know that we're driving those people here. So that's something that we're really making a case for this year, not necessarily as a part of the budget, but to get more folks in, because that spending, those active dollars in our not just our grant-funded orgs, but all of our art and cultural community is going to be excellent for all of us.
Tony, I understand we are just a day away from a big deadline in the next round of Spark District grants. Who can apply for those, and where does the funding come from for those?
Great. So every year we raise money. So we do a big annual awards gala. We have we bring in speakers. So like we brought in Christo this year. Sometimes there's margin when we get a sponsor for that. And when we stack up those dollars, we can re-grant those for artists and projects. And this is the Spark District. This is the biggest grant cycle ever. It's the 2016 cycle, but grants are due tomorrow at midnight. We want to make sure that folks know that tomorrow at midnight, it's not Friday. I told somebody Friday earlier in the week, and I'm desperate to let them know that it's not Friday.
If you're listening, Thursday. It's not Friday.
Yeah, that dude. So anyway, these are individual artists, projects. It can be a person. It can be an org. There are questions about your org. You know, when you go through, if you have to be a 501c3. It can't be a for-profit, that sort of thing.
Daniel. And all of that granting comes from private funding mm-hmm. that we raise. And so what we're really happy about is we've had organizations like Florida Blue step up who say, we want to see more art and culture in Jacksonville. So they've actually created that special category this year. And we're always on the lookout for more organizations that are looking to support arts and culture, because we can definitely help facilitate that with
and
them.
And it's a really wide range of people who have received those Spark grants in the past. I know one of them was Lyricist Lounge, Mal Jones, hip-hop for kids doing hip-hop in the street.
Yeah, it's like a hall of fame, the alumni, for this this group. I mean, you've got Mob, you've got Swamp Radio, which has really rippled out and grown, and then you've got the Songwriter Residency. Brad's group is
Sculpture Walk.
Yeah, Sculpture Walk is amazing. Yeah, so really rarefied air. If you're competitive. So you know, it's a lot of money this time, but it's going to be super competitive, and we know that we're going to get great results out of it.
And we just wrapped up the 2014-2015 cycle, and we actually have a great video that we posted on our Facebook and our YouTube channel that'll kind of show you the work that they've been doing for the past year, and you'll see some really amazing moments of downtown activation through arts and culture, so definitely check that out.
Okay, so if you're preparing your application at the last minute, go there, look at the video for inspiration as you're getting it in at the wire. So looking ahead to fall, we have something new, Culture Jam, right, coming to downtown beaches?
No, beach,
to the beaches.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, so we did Art in the Park this year, and that was in Hemming Park. We had a great time. We had over 35 organizations come out and participate. Our goal with that was to create something where people could really interact with the amazing arts and culture organizations that we have in town. You know, we have Art Walk every month downtown. We have Art Walks at the beaches where people really get to see local artists and artisans, but we didn't really find a chance where people could discover those organizations, which is one of the reasons that we did Art in the Park. It was great. We had about 4,500 people come out, all kinds of families and people that really enjoyed the day. So we were like, we have to do this again. We have to make it bigger and better, and we've got to bring it to Greater Jacksonville. So we're going to take it to the beach, and it's going to be called Culture Jam, and that's coming this November.
Right. Yeah, November, I think we're saying 21st. It's a Saturday.
Before Thanksgiving.
That's right, yeah. You can burn some calories before Thanksgiving.
All right. And we also have the Artist Development Series. And that is for artist professional development, right?
That's right. I mean, that's one of the things that we're committed to at the Cultural Council is supporting all these organizations and the community, but also the artists. We want to make sure that they have great opportunities, that they're getting the attention that they need. And so one of those needs that we've identified is people are looking for more of those development skills. So this series that we've been putting together for the last couple months, I think is really robust and strong. And it's really going to focus on things like putting portfolios together. How do you insure yourself when you're an artist that's working for yourself? How do you protect yourself, your finances? It's going to be every month we're going to have one of these workshops, and they're free to attend for these artists, which is amazing.
Right. And they're free to attend because of PNC Bank, I should say. PNC came on. They really like this. It's one of those ones where if Spark is giving fish, this is giving fishing poles. And we've had almost 100% capacity at these workshops. So keep your eye out, and we'll if that trend continues, we'll be doing it more and more. So
And we're gonna have local experts for that series as well as people from out of town that we're bringing in. So people can definitely stay on the lookout for that. Sign up for our newsletter on our website. That's the best way to find out about the workshops that are coming up.
And workshops you're planning to launch in October. Right?
That's right.
Yeah. All right. Well, we've been talking this morning with the Cultural Council of Greater Jacksonville Executive Director Tony Allegretti. Thanks for being here, Tony.
Thank you.
Thank you. And Daniel Austin, Communications Manager for the Council. Thanks, Daniel.
Thanks for having us, Jessica.
And Art in Public Places Director Christy Holacek. Thanks for being here, Christy.
Glad to be here.
Much more is still ahead on today's show. Later in the hour, a ceremony this Friday will honor Jacksonville's war heroes. But up next, a local nonprofit is asking for help easing the transition for homeless and disabled people about to move into apartments. That's next on First Coast Connect.
Join us for our annual Women's Health Conference, Girls Day Out, August 15th, Hyatt Regency Hotel. Afternoon keynote speaker Dinah Jordan's motivational messages ring loud and true about how we can make the choice to be happy, finding the funny in your life, taking responsibility for your own health, ways to bust stress, and in doing these four things can make a happier, healthier, more productive you. Good for You, Girls Day Out is hosted by Baptist Health and WJCT. For a complete list of speakers or to purchase your tickets, log on to wjct.org/goodforyou.
On the next reveal,
ha!
The con man
oh.
And his mentor.
Everybody, I just finished teaching The Art of Yen course. I teach traders all over the world how to trade the Japanese yen.
Meet the men behind a multi-million dollar investment scam. That's on the next Reveal from the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX.
Thursday at 1 on 89.9 WJCT. If you love All Things Considered, consider joining us a few hours early for Afternoons on WJCT. The Takeaway offers a fresh way to look at the news, featuring critical conversations, reports from the field, and listener participation. That's followed by The World, with engaging voices to illuminate what's going on around the globe and why it matters to you. It's the smart way to spend your afternoons. Weekdays from 2 to 6 on 89.9 WJCT.
Welcome back to First Coast Connect. I'm Jessica Palumbo, in for Melissa Ross. The nonprofit Ability Housing is asking for the public's help in their mission to provide affordable housing for adults with disabilities or at risk of homelessness. Shannon Nasworth, Executive Director of Ability Housing, is here in studio with more about their latest community effort in Jacksonville's West Side and a crowdfunding campaign to make that happen. Shannon, thanks for being here. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you so much.
And you said just about a week away now from the move-in date at this new community.
Yes, we are building 43 new apartments on the west side, and we were hoping we could start moving people in this week, but we just weren't quite able to get all the inspections done. So next week on Tuesday, we'll start moving formerly homeless persons into a new, brand new apartments. It's really lovely, and we're really excited.
You still need some help, though, making sure that that transition is easy for these people. And what are you asking for? And this is a crowdfunding campaign, right?
Correct. Yes, it's a crowdfunding campaign. It's the first time we've ever done something like this. And we're moving people in who have been living on the streets for literally years, and they have nothing. And so what we're trying to do is provide everybody with a move-in kit. So just the really basic household needs, like plates, dishes, silverware, a set of sheets, some towels, toilet paper, trash cans, just those little things that really make moving into an apartment, mm-hmm. turn it into a home and a place that they can live forever. So,
But 43 of those kits adds up, the price adds up, and you've turned to the internet, to the greater community through crowdfunding, and it's been very successful so far, right?
It really has, and it's been just wonderful. This actually was the idea of a volunteer. She came to us and said, "Can I help with this?" And we were like, "Absolutely, thank you." And so far, we've raised 86% of our goal, so we only have about $2,000 left to go, and we'll have all the funds we need to buy all of the move-in kits. And actually, we may be able to have a little bit left over, and we're going to try and get some money to buy beds for everybody as well.
Okay. So right now, no beds in the new apartments.
Well, actually, one of the donors for the campaign heard about our need for beds as well. And he said, if you want to redirect my resources to the beds, whatever you guys need and what will help best. So at least for the first people moving in, we've identified a place where we can get some beds at a really good rate. So they'll have beds.
Okay. Tell us a little bit more about what Ability Housing does in general in this community.
Sure. We're a local nonprofit, and what we do is provide affordable housing. The difference is we focus on rental housing that is affordable for persons with disabilities and people exiting homelessness. When we help somebody, we are literally moving them off the streets and into a permanent home of their own. Most people stay with us for about a year or two and then move on to other housing in the community. But some of the individuals we help have really significant disabilities, and they're going to need the deep affordability that we provide for a long time.
Now, the fundraising campaign is on a site called CrowdRise. That's the URL for that is crowdrise.com/move-in-kit.
Yes.
Move-in kit. And is there a minimum amount people can give through the site?
No, anything will help. We've had donations from, I think the lowest was $10 and the highest was $5,000. It has run the gamut.
Are you thinking about crowdfunding now going forward as something that is going to be more central to what you do?
I think so, and mostly as a way to help people engage with what we're doing. We've had a lot of people who have asked, how can I help? And really, this is very impactful for the people we're moving into these apartments. So any way we can help people, help the people, you know, get involved and be engaged with what we're trying to do, we want to provide that opportunity.
Right.
Jacksonville's a very generous community and people really want to be involved. And this is an excellent way to do that.
When you're thinking about these kits and the items, the plates, the towels, these are tangible items. And I think, you know, maybe that helps people understand I'm actually giving for this very specific purpose rather than sort of this nebulous I'm giving to a charity, right?
Exactly. I mean, it really is. You're helping buy a specific box of items that every one of us knows we need when we're at home. And somebody who's coming in off the streets is going to be given this box as a gift when they move into their apartment. And we start the move-ins next week. We're really excited. We have a bunch of volunteers that are going to help us move the people in, get them, you know, we've had some furniture donated, so we're going to be moving all that in starting next week. And it's we're so excited. It's been a lot of years getting to this point, and we're really thrilled.
And each of these kits costs approximately $330.
Actually, no, we were able to get a reduced rate. Okay. So, and that's part of the reason why we kind of added the beds in. If we can really get these kits at the reduced rate, one of my staff is very good at negotiations. And so that's where, you know, we had estimated how much they were going to cost based upon looking, you know, at what each kit was going to cost. And then when we actually got involved, he was able to negotiate them down.
When we're thinking about the general issue of homelessness in Jacksonville and where we've come from and where we're going, how do you see that evolving here in Jacksonville?
Actually, we've made incredible progress. Jacksonville right now is on track to end veteran homelessness by the end of this year.
Right.
I know NPR yesterday had a piece about New Orleans having achieved that, and Jacksonville's really on track. Mm-hmm. If we don't hit it by December 31st, it will just be a few months afterwards, and that's really exciting. And we've also made a lot of progress in helping people with long-term chronic disabilities who've been homeless for a long time. We've made an incredible amount of progress. And overall, all homelessness is going down. Family homelessness, all of it is seeing reductions. And that's because collectively, all of the nonprofits are working together to really make sure we're helping everybody as efficiently and effectively as possible.
Great. And anything else people need to know about the fundraiser? And
please just go online, go to CrowdRise Move-In Kit, and please help us provide these move-in necessities for these individuals. We really appreciate everybody's support so far. And if they want more information, they can go to our website, abilityhousing.org. Lots of information there.
All right. That is Shannon Nasworth, Executive Director of Ability Housing of Northeast Florida. Thank you, Shannon, for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Up next, how you can celebrate Jacksonville's veterans this week. Back in a moment on First Coast Connect.
On the next Fresh Air, why sexual predators sometimes escape justice for far too long. Women in four states told police former NFL star Darren Sharper had drugged and sexually assaulted them, but it took nearly 3 years for investigators to connect the dots and arrest him. We'll talk with ProPublica's T. Christian Miller. Join us.
Weekdays at noon on 89.9 WJCT, community-supported public radio.
Listeners love Relax Radio.
My name is Harry Reagan. I got hooked immediately because it's just the kind of radio station I've always been looking for and never found until now.
When you make a $120 gift to WJCT, you'll receive an HD radio so you can tune in to Relax. Call 904-353-9528 or go online to wjct.org/relax for more information.
10 years after Katrina, New Orleans has come way back, but there is now a whole different set of problems.
They entrusted me to take a loan application, and it's taking 6 months, and they still don't have an answer.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. A city once with too much water now has a banking desert. It's next time on Marketplace from 8 p.m.
Weeknights at 6 on 89.9 WJCT, community-supported public radio.
WJCT and Community First Credit Union are proud to announce that Mary Enworth will be this year's morning keynote speaker at Teach. Mary is co-author of Pathways to the Common Core. She is deputy director of middle schools at the Teachers Reading and Writing Project, Columbia University. Mary is just one of the many great speakers you will hear throughout the day. For more information or to purchase tickets, go to wjct/teach.
Welcome back to First Coast Connect. I'm Jessica Palumbo, sitting in for Melissa Ross. This Friday, Jacksonville is celebrating National Purple Heart Day with a ceremony at the Jacksonville Veterans Memorial Wall. Here to tell us more is Ralph Sevilius with Vietnam Veterans of America. Welcome to the show, Dr. Sevilius.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
And we also have in studio Eddie Harrison, who is a patriot and a clearly decorated veteran himself. Good morning, Mr. Harrison.
Good morning, ma'am.
Thank you for being here. Now, I understand Friday is an observance ceremony. This is National Purple Heart Day, but here in Jacksonville, we'll be celebrating. And Dr. Sevilius, where will we be celebrating here?
We will be celebrating at the Veterans Memorial Wall right next to Everbank Field. It's going to be at 6:30 p.m., and we will have a POW-MIA, which is Prisoner of War Missing in Action ceremony, where we will be remembering all those that have that are still missing.
Mm. And is this specifically honoring any Vietnam veterans or any wars?
Friday is specifically for honoring Vietnam veterans because this is the 40th year since the fall of Saigon. So we are definitely honoring Vietnam veterans.
And are we expecting a big turnout? Do we know who's coming on Friday?
We don't. I have spoke with several officials, Bill Nelson's office and other officials, and they are going to be sending representatives there. We have been calling almost everybody that we have on our list who have Purple Hearts, and we're trying to get a great turnout of the Purple Heart recipients.
Now, tell us about what a Purple Heart means. What does it mean if you have a Purple Heart?
A Purple Heart is given to any person who is wounded in combat action. It's also given to those who are killed in action. And it means, it was founded by George Washington. He started it with the Legion of Merit back in 1782. And then it was pretty much dropped in 1932-33, Douglas MacArthur, General Douglas MacArthur, reinstated the Purple Heart as the 200th anniversary of George Washington's birth. So since then, we've had the Purple Heart awarded to every single person who's been wounded in action.
Who is invited to the ceremony this Friday?
Well, this Friday, we invite the public and everyone that can attend this particular meeting because there will be representation from the city, which we are very grateful to have.
And families of service members who may have been lost in action in Vietnam, right?
By all means, yes. And that's who the military order, the Purple Heart, we give service to members of the missing in action, members of the family whose loved ones and relatives have been awarded the Purple Heart.
Now, what do people need to know if they're thinking about coming out to the ceremony on Friday?
Well, they can expect to see a very professional ceremony out there representing and honoring our Purple Heart recipients. And we were glad to be appreciative if they attend and come and see us.
Mm. Now, the Veterans Memorial Wall is, if people are not familiar with it, can you describe where that is?
It's right there adjacent on the west side of Everbank Field, which Everbank Field, of course, is the Jacksonville Jaguars, where they play. And it's a memorial wall to every single person who died while they were in service, in the service, whether it be killed in action or wounded in action or just died while they were in the service.
Now, is this ceremony personal for either of you?
Very personal to me.
Why is that?
Because I have seen those that are wounded, those that have been killed. And as far as I'm concerned today, I represent them, and I will speak for them if they can't speak for themselves.
Yes.
And you were serving alongside them.
Yes, I have. I spent 2 years in Vietnam. I'm the recipient of 4 Purple Hearts, so I know the feeling.
Wow. 4 Purple Hearts. It's an honor to be sitting next to you. And how about you, Dr. Sevelius?
I was wounded in Vietnam. I just received 1 Purple Heart because I stepped on a landmine and was medevaced out and medically retired from the Army. But I do have the same feeling for all Purple Heart recipients. It is a camaraderie that is really close, and we all are brothers.
Yes. When I saw that the Vietnam was the focus of the ceremony, that hit home for me as well. My great uncle never returned from Vietnam. So there's a Purple Heart at our house in honor of him.
And that's the ceremony that we're going to have. We're going to have what's called the White Table, or the POW/MIA, Missing in Action, a table where we celebrate, or not celebrate, but we remember those who are missing in action.
Well, the ceremony, again, is 6:30 this Friday evening at the Jacksonville Veterans Memorial Wall that's adjacent to Everbank Field. Thank you so much, gentlemen, for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
All right. And we'll have just more ahead on First Coast Connect.
Inside a rundown building in Newark, New Jersey, there's an experiment with sophisticated temperature, lighting, and plumbing controls. It's a vertical farm.
The plants are really getting a white glove lifestyle experience. They have people catering to their every need.
I'm Melissa Block, the hopes for indoor farming. Later on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Weekdays at 4 on 89.9 WJCT, community-supported public radio.
New name, new look. Join us for our annual Women's Health Conference, Girls Day Out, August 15th, Hyatt Regency Hotel. Morning keynote speaker, mental health advocate Jessie Close, who wants to change how people talk and think about mental illness. An ambassador for Bring Change to Mind, a not-for-profit organization founded by Jessie's sister, actress Glenn Close. Jessie fights stigma and misunderstandings to create a clearer picture of mental disorders. Good for you. Girls Day Out is hosted by Baptist Health and WJCT. For a complete list of speakers or to purchase your tickets, log on to wjct.org/goodforyou.
He promised me it was the best sandwich ever. I considered and then traded away my Twinkie. Sucker. On the next Snap Judgment, from PRX and NPR, Fool's Gold. Snap Judgment, storytelling with a beat. Do not miss it.
Sundays at 1 on 89.9 WJCT.
I decided to close the door on gambling, blackjack, poker. It didn't matter what form, that part of my life was now over. I fell in love and I moved to Seattle to be with this woman. And, you know, Seattle is a little bit different from New York, the city. It is a city where nobody is trying to accomplish anything.
Join us next time for the Moth Radio Hour. True stories told live from the Public Radio Exchange, PRX.org.
Saturdays at 3 on 89.9 WJCT.
Welcome back to First Coast Connect. I'm Jessica Palumbo. Finally this hour, WJCT Music Director David Luckin is here with some previews of what we can hear tonight on Electro Lounge starting at 9 on 89.9. One of those artists featured on tonight's episode is Billie Holiday. That's a name a lot of us consider synonymous with the blues, right? But David wants us to know there's another side to Billie Holiday. David.
Well, that's because when Billie started out, and thank you for having me on, she did some really happy music, anti-depression music. She did lots of Gershwin and Berlin and all those happy songs that kept the wolf from the door, as they said back in the Depression. And I think most people think of Billie as that the later period where it's all kind of depressing and down.
Yeah.
And it's kind of, it's not my favorite. So I thought I'd let people know with tonight's program, at least the first hour or 45 minutes, playing the happy stuff. And we've got a great example. Well, let's tell people, first of all, she had a really kind of tragic life, you know,
right.
Lost her parents at 12, lived with relatives, arrested for prostitution at 14, discovered by John Hammond in 1933, right after he finished his last session with Bessie Smith. The next day, he recorded his first session with Billie Holiday. And then, of course, he went on to discover Santana, Janis Joplin, Bob Dylan, Bruce Springsteen. So we could do a whole show on John Hammond. But Hammond is a brilliant guy, and he found Billie. And we've got a little sample of the joyous side of Billie Holiday that you will hear tonight.
All right.
Nice work if you can get it. You may know that that was introduced in 1937 by Fred Astaire in Damsel in Distress, written by George Gershwin and his brother Ira. And that's typical of Billie, taking a great song from a film and swinging it. But here's the best part, Jessica. Teddy Wilson on the piano there drew the band from Duke Ellington's band, Count Basie's band, and Benny Goodman's band. So he just had the pick of the best musicians there were. And Billie went on to tell the story years later that she patterned her singing style after Lester Young's saxophone playing from Basie's band and with her. So it's a really great family story of the best musicians in New York from all the great bands getting together to back Billie and making some, as you can tell, some really nice, upbeat. It's nice work if you can get it.
It's not the Billie that a lot of us think of when
Well, because you think of Strange Fruit, which is a brilliant poem mm-hmm. turned into a song, and the later years where she's more down and musically. I don't know what she was personally, but this is just happy stuff. And we'll play about 8 songs, and we're going to end the mix tonight with a few remixes on how people in the 2000s are still taking Billie and
cool.
making her sound fresh today. And it's not bad. I've heard some people remix Billie with dance beats, and it's like, no, stop. These remixes are pretty tastefully done. So
still jazzy.
It is, and kind of dreamy. So,
cool.
And, oh, I forgot to say, 100th anniversary, or 100th birthday, April, just a few months ago. So her and Frank, 100 years old this year.
Crazy.
The second one we've got, Joss Stone, new album. She was crate digging in an L.A. used record shop and got drawn to the world and in reggae and different kinds of music. And then she hooked up with Damian Marley, who said, why don't you do a reggae album?
And we have that album here. It's called Water for Your Soul. And David gave me the CD to listen to in the car. And I got here this morning and I didn't want to get out of my car to come into the station. I was trying to finish a
song. We call that a driveway moment.
Right.
Yeah.
I had one. Joss Stone.
There you go. People tell me at night they're driving home and they sit in their garage till the song ends for electro alarms before they go in the house. And the family's wondering, what are you doing out there in the garage? Here's a little Joss Stone from her latest.
Love.
That's Love Me, the first track on Water for Your Soul. David's loving it, grooving.
It's such nice, happy music. I mean, who doesn't move to reggae? It's infectious. And I've been in pubs in England, in 70 and 80-year-old people. You just see their heads bobbing up and down as soon as Marley comes on. It's kind of a music that I think... it's been around for quite a while. I bought my first reggae 45 in 69, Desmond Dekker and the Israelites. So it's a music that America knows well, influenced by the Jamaicans sitting on the island listening to Miami radio. So you hear a lot of the early Marley and the early reggae. You hear a lot of Curtis Mayfield and Temptations and music like that, because that's what they were listening to. And then they turned it into their style. And Joss does a great job. Yeah. This sounds real traditional. It doesn't sound like a novelty.
Joss Stone in rotation on Electro Lounge. You heard it Saturday night on Electro Lounge here on 89.9. Electro Lounge starts tonight at 9 here on 89.9. That's music director David Luckin. Thanks for sharing, David.
My pleasure. Join us tonight at 9 for Billie Holiday, the Everything But the Blues.
Yeah, the happy Billie Holiday. Who knew? That's our program. Thanks to all of our guests and all of our callers. This show's producer is Sean Birch. Have questions or comments about First Coast Connect? Send us an email at firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. And make sure to subscribe to our daily podcast on iTunes or Stitcher. That's Jessica Palumbo, and you're listening to First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT Jacksonville. We'll be right back here tomorrow at 9. Have a great day.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.